Welcome to the Gym Shorts podcast series. I am your host, Kathy Smith. We are discussing in utero and early childhood neurological development. We will meet with Dr. Kelsey Christoffel throughout the podcast series to keep up to date on developing research in pediatric growth. Today we are meeting with our wonderful guest, Dr. Kelsey Christoffel, who is a pediatric neurologist in Washington, D.C. Hi, Dr. Kelsey. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Kathy. Thanks for having me.
We all believe that literacy should start really early with kids, even while they're in your utero. So I just wanted to see, what was your favorite childhood book?
I think that I had a lot as a kid, but I think what really came to the top of my mind is a book that was called Dealing with Dragons, which I remember it distinctly because it was the first chapter book that that my parents read to me. And I really liked, like, we would read a chapter at a time, and I liked the continuation of the story over multiple days to weeks, however long it took us to finish it. That's what came to top of mind for me.
We just love to hear what people love to look at and read when they're little. So anyways, let's get started. Dr. Kelsey, first, can you please explain, what is a pediatric neurologist? What do you do?
The topic of pediatric neurology is very diverse. So there are a lot of different kinds of conditions, and essentially we take care of anything that affects the central or peripheral nervous system in a child. So that could be things like traumatic brain injury, epilepsy, seizures, congenital brain malformations, brain infections, strokes. It could be things that affect the spinal cord, or things that affect the peripheral nervous system or muscles as well. So there's a really diverse group of conditions that we treat.
Wow, that's a lot of things that you do. So if you have a primary focus, Dr. Kelsey, what is it that you're doing most of your work on currently?
So I was one of the people who did a little bit extra after my residency. So I did a fellowship in prenatal and neonatal neurology, so focusing more on babies. And that is what I spend a lot of my time doing. I also see some of the general neurology cases in clinic too. But for kind of my specialized area, I see sometimes I see pregnant women who come in because of concerns for congenital brain malformations in their babies, or other kind of early signs of neurologic disease that we can see prenatally. And then I also follow those babies after they're born, and also spend some time in the neonatal intensive care unit taking care of babies who have neurologic disease and injury in there.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for, you know, being a part of that community. It's just amazing work. So do you talk with families and talk about, like, prenatally, what are genetic predispositions and some steps that they can take to either reduce or eliminate the potential for disorders? Or what kind of things do you talk about or counsel with?
Yeah, I think a lot of times people might not know that they have a genetic difference that could be passed on to their baby. So in many cases, it might be something that's found in one pregnancy, that there may not have been a way that anyone would have known that it would happen. So genetic differences either can be inherited sometimes, sometimes if one parent has a genetic difference and then the other parent has the same kind of genetic difference in the same location when they meet, then that can cause disease. While a person could carry a genetic difference in their body, they might not be affected by it because they have one normal copy. But then when two different copies come together, then that can be the cause of disease. So a lot of times it can come on as a surprise, which is to say we all have some kind of genetic differences in our DNA, and there's no way that you could know about a lot of them. So which is all to say a lot of parents kind of blame themselves and ask that same question, like, what could we have done to prevent this? And the answer is nothing. There's no way that you could have known unless you had analyzed your DNA for some reason earlier. but that's not commonplace to do. There are some genetic screening tests that are offered that look for some, but not all of those conditions. So that's something you can opt for in your pregnancy to learn about your risk for those things. If there is something that does run in the family, there's been another child who is affected by a condition. There are some options for things like in vitro fertilization, where you do pre-implantation genetic screening of those embryos to check for the genetic difference, and you can select an embryo that does not have the affected gene. So
Wow.
those are some things that people can do. But I would say for the most part, aside from taking your prenatal vitamin and taking good regular care of yourself, these things are often outside of people's control.
Do you see any conditions that you work with that are more prevalent, are extremely common or increasing in babies and kids nowadays that seem to be spiking?
I think that there are a lot of things, so in particular with what I do, there are a lot of things that we're diagnosing more of in the prenatal period. So things like, just to name a couple differences in how the brain develops, things like agenesis of the corpus callosum, where the middle part of the brain that kind of connects the two hemispheres doesn't form correctly. Or something like an absent septum pellucidum, where there's a small kind of space in the middle part of the brain that doesn't form correctly. That's one of the most common, two of the most common reasons that women are referred to us in pregnancy. And we see a lot of it because I think we're getting really good at identifying it. And I think because fetal imaging has gotten so good, we're identifying a lot of things that may or may not have a clinical impact or a significant impact on people long term. So I think in some of those conditions, so those two in particular, there may be people walking around, adults walking around with those same brain findings, and they have no idea because they haven't had any significant impacts from it. So that's one thing in particular that I think we're diagnosing things that probably bring on a lot of anxiety in the prenatal period for parents, that because we can see them better, we're diagnosing them more, but they may or may not have an impact on the child. That's something I think with time we'll understand a little bit better.
One thing, as we're seeing in kids, and a lot of times educators are seeing more so in preschool and pre-K, is the number of children that are being diagnosed with autism. And it looks like those numbers continue to rise. I noted that according to the Center for Disease Control, one in 36 children are diagnosed with autism today. And that's an increase from one in 44, 2 years ago.
I think that there's been a lot of research into trying to understand this increase that we've seen. It's a real increase that we've seen, and there's been a lot of debate about whether that's due to a specific change in our environment or if it's maybe related to just more awareness of the condition or broader diagnostic criteria for the condition. And I think it's a little bit hard to say for sure. I don't think that we have a clear answer as to why we're seeing this increase. I think, or I suspect that it's likely multifactorial. I don't think there's enough evidence to blame any one specific thing. And I also think that doing so can lead to a lot of finger pointing and guilt that parents might feel. So like, did I hold my baby enough, or did I look at my baby enough? And I just think that moms in particular tend to hold on to a lot of guilt, feelings of guilt about that. And I just think that that's really unfounded and unfair, an unfair burden to put on mothers. So I think we have a lot more research and understanding to come on that.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kelsey. It's so important for us to always be positive to moms and families that have things that they have to deal with. And I love that you are, letting people know they don't have to have that burden. It's not anyone's fault. You mentioned you work with kids with brain injuries, but mostly babies. If you are working with kids, how would you treat a child who has one or more concussions?
Sometimes I see kids with concussions in my kind of general older kid clinic. So a concussion is basically anytime you hit your head forcefully and then you have lingering symptoms afterwards. That's what I would put in the category of a concussion. Most of the time, to be called a concussion, you don't have any significant like brain imaging findings, so there's no bleeding or fractures or anything like that. That would be more of a significant traumatic brain injury, but a concussion would be more of a what we would call a mild traumatic brain injury. We treat mild traumatic brain injuries or concussions by allowing for a short period of rest, usually like 2 days, 2 to 3 days of kind of resting and refraining from activities. And then we really try to get kids back to their regular activities on a kind of a graduated return. We call it graduated return to play. So we start with step one, where they're going back to school. They're not doing any exercise or any physical activities, just trying to go to school and participate in school. If they find that doing things in school kind of aggravate their symptoms, we can do things to kind of make some accommodations, like allow for longer test time, ask for handwritten notes instead of, or paper copies of notes instead of using screens, because screens can be aggravating. We try to limit their screen time during this time while they're recovering. And then when they're able to do those things, those kind of regular just school activities without symptoms, then they can start doing the next step, which would be like light aerobic activities. So they can go to one of their, if they're like in soccer practice, they can go to their soccer practice and they can run around, but would not be good for them to have like a lot of really vigorous activity. More just kind of light activity, no contact. And then once they're able to do things like that, then they can step it up another level and do things like dribbling the ball, still no contact. Once they're able to do things like that without any symptoms, then they can go into kind of more regular types of practices. And so it's really just kind of increasing their activity level in increments and making sure if they do start feeling symptoms at that level, then they go back down to the level that they last tolerated. So it's just kind of an incremental, gradual return to their activities. But the progress should always be kind of gradually increasing those rather than going from resting to back to full contact sports.
Do you work with kids that have individual education plans? Do you take a collaborative approach with the educators?
A lot of our patients might have those kinds of needs, and it's absolutely important that we collaborate and communicate with those team members. So the teachers, special education teachers, speech therapists, paraprofessionals, anyone in that kind of support team for the child, is, I think, probably more the expert on their learning and their kind of behavior at school. So I always defer to them and their insights and their observations because they're with the kids a lot more than in the 30 or 40 minute visit that we would have with them. So their input is super, super important. I think as a neurologist, the main thing that that we do is make sure that the diagnosis is understood by the other team members and that and that there's a plan in place for if there's something like if a child has seizures, making sure that A, that we're treating the seizures the best that we can because we know that that really impacts the learning environment if a kid is having uncontrolled seizures all day long. Can also make the team feel really uncomfortable and worried. So I'm trying to have the best control possible of seizures in that case. And then just making sure everyone understands the reason for the neurologic diagnosis and sorry about that. And what their symptoms mean.
Are there any tips that you recommend for parents working with kids who have a neuromuscular condition to help them navigate their daily routines and activities? Are there better ways to help with their learning?
So neuromuscular conditions are kind of a subgroup of conditions where there's an issue with how the muscles and the nerves communicate. So it's often something that, again, there's a wide spectrum of even of neuromuscular conditions, but a lot of times it might be something that just affects kind of the muscles and motor skills of the child. And it's possible that many kids with some types of neuromuscular conditions might have normal cognition and normal learning. So I think in that case, it's good to know about that and to not treat them differently, and have kind of similar learning expectations for them. But in cases where they might have, there are some neuromuscular conditions that there are cognitive impacts or intellectual disabilities, and I think just making sure that there's early intervention for those kids, so early supports, early physical therapies, and early speech therapies is one of the best things that we can do. So usually once a kid has a diagnosis like that, they're usually enrolled in some of those services already. Sometimes it's actually the teachers or people in the community who are taking care of the kid who notice issues in their development, and they're actually the ones that send them to a neurologist to actually lead to the diagnosis. So there's a lot of back and forth in that relationship too. But I think just early engagement and close observation and then trying to integrate kids as much as possible, as much as is deemed safe and enjoyable for the kid is important.
Love it. And last, Dr. Kelsey, what kinds of new diagnostic research are you seeing on the horizon for kids with diseases and conditions of the brain and nervous system? What are is there projects that your community is working on right now?
I think there's a lot that is potentially on the horizon. One thing that comes to mind is the potential for gene replacement therapies. So there's a really great example in SMA, spinal muscular atrophy, which is a really significant neuromuscular condition that affects babies early on and can cause kids to really not be able to walk or have very significant they usually have very significant impairments and shortened lifespans. And there's been recent development of new therapies for this condition where they use virus derived vector to replace the faulty gene. and have a they'll have a normal copy of that gene kind of inserted into their DNA, and then they'll have the working their motor neuron cells will begin to function normally. So it can really
Wow.
essentially restore a really good quality of life for these kids. So that's really, really cool.
That's so
And
exciting.
I'm hopeful and really interested to see what else comes down the line for gene replacement therapies and in a lot of these conditions. And then something that I'm working on and really interested in is using some advanced quantitative imaging techniques to find better brain markers in fetal MRIs to correlate with developmental outcomes to help kind of narrow down, kind of going back to something I said earlier, sometimes we find things prenatally and we aren't certain what they mean, and that can be really anxiety provoking for parents and families. And so trying to find, are there better brain markers that we can identify and quantify in this prenatal period to be able to give you more accurate prognosis prenatally?
Wow.
So that's something that I'm particularly interested in and working on myself.
Do you know if AI is going to become very commonplace in your in being in the neuropediatric community? Is it already being used? Do you think, what are your thoughts on AI? I mean, it seems like the big buzzword.
Yeah. I think I know very little about AI. I think I guess there are some potential areas where I think it could be helpful in terms of things where we are dealing with a lot of data, and that would be like EEGs. We have that's one of the tests that we do very commonly in neurology. We put electrodes all over the scalp and then measure electrical activity in the brain, essentially. And we can have hours and hours of EEG data for one kid. And it takes a lot of training and special skills to be able to sit and look through those EEGs and read them. And that's what epileptologists do. But I wonder, that's something where there's just a lot of data. Right now, humans do it, and I wonder what the applications of AI could be there. But there's a lot I don't know about AI, so.
You and me both, Dr. Kelsey. I don't know much about it either, but it just seems like a buzzword.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to say thank you so much for taking some time and sharing with us what you do, a little bit about neurological pediatrics and the amazing things you do to help kids. Both young little ones and babies and prenatally. So thank you, Dr. Kelsey. We are grateful for you and the work that you do is life-changing. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, have a great rest of your day.